May all beings be happy. May all beings be healthy. May all beings be free from harm. May all beings love life. May all beings awaken. Welcome to another Cuke Audio Podcast. I'm D.C. Poobah of Cuke Audio and Cuke Archives, preserving the legacy of Shinryu Suzuki and those whose paths crossed his, and anything else that comes to mind. I pray that you and yours are safe and comfortable, free of economic hardship, and able to get out and do whatever it is you want within the limitations of the universal precept of do as little harm as possible. Today we have three draft pieces for a work in progress, Tassahara Stories, The Early Years with Shinryu Suzuki. So I'll start reading that as soon as we've had our pause to meditate. So when you hear the bell, hit pause, if you wish, and meditate or whatever for as long as you wish. And when you're through and ready to come back, hit unpause. And we'll all come back at the same time, and we'll hit the bell to end the meditation or whatever, and get into reading more Tassahara Stories. From On a Boulder. A short wooden pallet bridges the few feet between two boulders behind one of the student cabins. Peter Schneider and David Stindelrast are sitting on the flat surface of the one overlooking the creek. A KQED TV camera is running as they speak and laugh a lot. Peter is the director of Tassahara, and David Stindelrast, who we call Brother David, is a Benedictine monk who's already had a lot of experience practicing Zen on the East Coast. And he's in the, let's say, the Thomas Merton contemplative insight tradition of Catholicism. Peter, what I wanted to ask you was whether or not you plan to go to heaven. David, for heaven's sake, yes. Peter, yes, and what's that mean to you? David, in Christian terms, it means ultimate union with God, and in Buddhist terms, it means union with ultimate reality, nirvana. Peter, of course, some Buddhists believe nirvana is some sort of state after death, but Roshi does, and he believes that nirvana is right here and now. David, well, in a very real sense, the Christian who lives in union with God is also in heaven here and now, and his death is relatively insignificant. How do you think this place is going to develop? I see two elements here. On the one hand is the strict monastic element. It's a real monastery with celibate monks and so forth. Uh-oh. And then on the other hand, you have married couples living here and folks with children and so forth. Do you think that one of these two trends will eventually take over? DC comment. Well, that's a loose use of the term monks. The only monks there were David, Suzuki, and Gobun. There was a lot of celibacy among single men and women, but it was temporary and not compulsory, though we were not expected to fiddle around and start new relationships there. But stuff happens. Peter, I don't know. I think that people who are religious in a strange sense of the word would prefer neither living in a total secular life out in the world, nor living one that is totally monastic. I think of a community of families with a school and their own ways of raising food, but one that is not isolated. David, in other words, a Buddhist kibbutz. In the Christian sense, too, monasticism has been really defined as a nostalgia for the early Christian community. For exactly that, families sharing everything and living a more religious life than society at large. Do you think then that this is a sort of pattern for a new development of Buddhism in this country? And do you think that there are some possibilities of cooperation with other monastic traditions, like with the Benedictine tradition right near here? He's referring there to the new Kamaldoli Hermitage in Big Sur. Peter, I've been here a year, and that would be like asking a freshman in college if he thinks the university can change the world. But when you look at, the very slight difference between our two different communities and our different ways, and then there are people who are killing for my country, right or wrong, around the world. Compared to that, our communities, they're almost exactly alike. David, in this sense, then, monasticism would really have a very important mission in the world because there are monks both in the East and the West, and just by the way that they speak the same language of meditation and spiritual practice, there is a bridge already existing, and all we need to do is use it for peace and for communication. Peter, yes, I think that we're all getting together, and I think that as you come east, I may also return west. David, I hope so. Well, it means a lot to me, of course. Our life as Benedictine is completely impregnated with ritual, too, but you get used to it. And here for me is something new. The meals, for instance, are highly ritualized, or the bath with the ritual baths and all that carries over to other parts of daily life. And it makes me more aware of what's going on. It increases your awareness. Peter, after people eat our way for some time, they begin to realize how their teeth meet and how they swallow. And if you stop eating and close your eyes and listen to the rest of the people eat, it's like an enormous field of all different kinds of bugs going num 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 num. And still, it's very silent. You become so much more aware. David, I guess that even if you don't do that, it's very beautiful to have the three bowls and every day different things in these three bowls. From Bill Shurtleff's diary. 1968, June 10th. I go to live at Tassajara, up the Carmel Valley and the Santa Lucia Mountains. Give away all my possessions, leaving my lengthy journal, poems, and Nigerian wood sculpture with a friend, and hitchhike down the coast. Highway 1, with only a backpack, to live there for 2.5 years as a Zen monk under Shunryu Suzuki, Japanese Zen master, sit 5-day Tongaryo, and have my first superb meditation samadhi, a totally blissful, transcendent, one-pointed state. I feel like meditating all night. Soon I copy down my first recipe ever for gluten bread, moist, heavy, and delicious, which starts my long, serious interest in food. Start work as a stonemason. Friends include Dan Welsh, Jeff Broadbent, Chino Sensei, Paul and Ruthie Disco, Ed Brown. July 20th, talk with Peter Schneider about my haughtiness. August, start sitting full lotus. September 4th through 10th, first session, tough but beautiful. November 1st, experience of cold, Tassajara. It's terrible, but I try to wear as little clothing as possible. Read Huxley's Perennial Philosophy, Yogananda's Autobiography of a Yogi, and Prabhavananda's translation of the Bhagavad Gita. Dennis Sampson says, Steve Brown was my cabin mate. Bill Shurtleff and Donnie were behind. They'd get a lot of lanterns to heat their room up. Almost asphyxiated us. The cold really got to some people, including Dennis. After evening zazen, he'd go to the dining room and stand by the wood-burning stove that would still be going from earlier, warm up, then go as quickly as he could to his cabin and jump into his sleeping bag with his long sleeve underclothes on. The cold just didn't bother me as much as many others. I'd like to get into my sleeping bag naked and enjoyed the initial ice-cold jolt, knowing that it was about to warm up. I had an Arctic sleeping bag I'd ordered from L.L. Bean in Maine. So cozy. In the early years, I'd go to the Zendo with the same thin gray polyester robe we'd all been issued for the July heat of the first practice period. And no underwear. I found it invigorating to walk to the Zendo that way in cold weather. Once I got sitting in the Zendo, which was the same temperature as outside, I'd be all compact in lotus position and pretty soon would start feeling warm. As soon as I was back in my room, though, I'd put on warm clothes for the day. In Doksan, Suzuki asked me how wearing so little in such cold weather worked for me. I said, fine. And he said, good, pretty good. I think he saw that I was not doing so to prove something. It was just something invigorating. He'd wear long underwear. Someone bought him a pair before in San Francisco, and he liked them. I only kept that one thin robe practice up for the first few years. After that, I got lazy and wore more. I never wore any socks, though, unless I was doing work that necessitated boots. Never unless it got down to the 20s. Then my toes would hurt, but higher than that, it just didn't bother me. We weren't supposed to wear socks in the Zendo, but some people needed socks and mittens or they'd get chilblains or frostbite. The worst was David Schneider. He really had a problem with chilblains. His hands would get all red and spotty. It hurt me to look at them, and it hurt him worse. There was a damp cloth in the entryway to the Zendo. Tassajara is a dusty place, and we were supposed to wipe our feet on it before entering. When it got cold, people would step over it. I stepped on it in freezing weather once, and it crunched under my feet, breaking the ice. It doesn't get that cold much, though. The first batch of robes were only gray robes. After that, they were black. And at some point, white jibon, or full-length white underrobes, were worn as well, which is always done in Japan. It made one look more fully dressed with the white V under the black V where they came together. Back to Bill's diary. November 16th, I start no eating between meals vow. November 26th, Lama Govinda visits Tassajara. Govinda was a sweet Austrian man who dressed in an elegant magenta robe and had a white beard. Tassajara, deep in that narrow valley, gets dark in the winter, and we were having a cold spell when he and his wife, Lee Gotami from India, were there. They ate in the Zendo with us, served with bowls on trays, hers with a bottle of Tabasco sauce. Suzuki treated Govinda with a great deal of respect and had Emma Bragdon take care of him and his wife. Govinda and Suzuki looked at Buddhist texts together. Govinda gave a talk. I'd read his Way of the White Clouds about his years studying Buddhism in Tibet. He described the coldest scenes, one I recall, where they'd boil water to wash their faces with, pour it into a bowl, and plunge their hands into the water, which already had a film of ice on top. And then he said that Tassajara was the coldest place he'd ever been. December 1st through 7th. First Rohatsu Sesshin. I am defeated on the fifth day by cold. Very humbling. At this time of my life, all my heroes are great spiritual figures. Milarepa, Dogen, Ramakrishna, Ramana Maharshi, Meister Eckhart. I want to devote the rest of my life to living like them, renouncing the world and practicing only meditation. But at the same time, I am bothered by the suffering in the outside world, especially hunger. I am torn between this solitary life and that of serving in the world. Which does the Bodhisattva choose? December. Publish the Tassajara food trip. Xerox copy of my cookbook, heavily macrobiotic, 63 pages, with a woodblock print of the Tibetan mantra Mandala Om Mani Padme Hum on page 1. send out about 100 copies. This is my second book and my first of many on food. One day at the baths, Peter Schneider came out of the 110-degree plunge too fast into the cold air and fainted, hitting his head on the hard floor. There was a spot of blood on his head and a drop on the floor. Bill Shurtleff and I were standing right there, and then Bill suddenly fainted and fell to the floor next to Peter. Within 30 seconds, they both sat up dazed. Peter said he was okay. I asked Bill what happened to him. He said he faints at the sight of blood. I was taken aback because he'd talked about working with Albert Schweitzer at Schweitzer's Hospital in Africa. He said it wasn't a problem there, so I thought either he'd avoided the patients who were bleeding or that he overcame such a reaction in that context, as actors who stutter do on stage. Bill said that army ants would march into the village. Army ants, as portrayed in film as terrifying monsters devouring all in their path who couldn't escape. Bill painted a different picture. He said that the villagers liked them because they cleaned everything so well, eating all the lice and other pests. He said he was sitting in his hut reading when they entered the open door, covering the floor like a creeping carpet. He picked up a few food items, slipped out a window, and watched them slowly and methodically pass through. He said that Schweitzer, who was known as an authority on Bach, would give lovely organ recitals in the evening. Unfortunately, they were only for the white people there, that Schweitzer didn't consider the natives to be properly educated to appreciate such fine culture. When Bill was work leader, he was thorough and exacting in taking care of Tassara's physical plant. He wasn't a total rule freak, but he did try to enforce the rule of working in silence. His micromanaging style with frequent feedback did cause some tension. I didn't have a problem with him because I was used to people telling me to be quiet, and I too have a nitpicky side and felt like a knife being sharpened when he'd bring his magnifying glass to what I was doing. I was a little hurt, though, when Bill told me while smiling that my complexion problem was due to repressed anger and hatred, but I thought about whether it was true or not and wondered how he could see something in me that I couldn't find. I was around a few altercations that were unusually fierce for Tassara between Bill and students who were not so appreciative of his management style. Back when we still had a brief work period during Sesshin, the most silent and harmonious time at Tassara, Bill and another student were struggling together to get a large stone out of a hole. Bill was making what he thought were helpful suggestions, and the other student suddenly reeled back, screamed, "Shut up!" and let loose a string of nasty epithets. That was inspiring in its rapid and well-articulated delivery. Bill was shocked. "You can't talk like that here, especially during Sesshin." That guy was a sweetheart, but he did not like to be told what to do. Once at a work meeting, when I was work leader, all students gathered around in a circle. I was asking people to do this and that. When I got to him, he responded with indignant anger. I walked up to him and kissed him right on the lips. and a smile slowly came across his face. Now, I think Bill should have known that that other fella you had to be careful with. And then there's Alan. I saw tall, muscular Alan Marlowe explode in Bill's face, loom over him, and threaten to pulverize him with the shovel he was holding if Bill didn't leave him alone. Diane came up and put her hand on his shoulder, going, "Down, boy, down, boy." Alan could get riled up, especially at an officer. And Bill, being work leader, was an officer. I remember wheeling a barrow load of dirt with Alan at my side, going on about some spat with the officers who denied him something, saying he was destined to be the avatar of the age and that he'd outlive them all and be burying their goddamn ashes one by one up on the hogback. Ha ha! Bill appreciated the diversity of it all. He said, "Suzuki Roshi attracted a great variety of students to a difficult practice. It was cold, hard, the most unlikely people you'd ever expect, like Lucille Harris, Stanley White, you, Bob Halpern, but not Dan and me. Austere, monastic types who like rarefied atmosphere. That's something unique, the way he attracted the unlikely ones." "That's an interesting list. I don't think I'd divide us into the same two groups, but his point is well made, and, Lucille Harris, Lulu, we all loved that good-natured bohemian who was the oldest person at Tassajara at the time. She had terrible posture. Stanley called her the humpback and was grossed out by all the varicose veins on her feet. It was clearly harder for her there than most, but she soldiered on, never complaining. And was she fun, always in good humor. After she'd returned to San Francisco, I'd visit her. If I was in North Beach, where she had an apartment, I'd ring her bell and she'd send a key down on a little parachute. Once at Tassajara, I came out to the dorm with just my thin gray robe and nothing under when she walked by. I called out her name. She turned and I flashed her. She was delighted and walked on cackling." For Bill, two Shosan ceremony memories stand out from his time at Tassajara. One was when I asked Suzuki if he could put Buddhism in a nutshell, and he answered with two words: "Everything changes." Bill said, "It's the same thing that Henry Ford had carved in stone above his headquarters in Dearborn, Michigan. Of all things, only one is sure, that everything changes." At another Shosan, Bill said, "Dan Welsh walked the full length of the Zendo absolutely quietly without asking a question. And there was this loud silence. He looked at Suzuki Roshi and finally said, 'Suzuki Roshi, listen, quick.' Crickets. And then all of a sudden our ears shifted into a new gear and we could hear all these crickets chirping all over the place. It was the strangest sensation because before that it seemed like everything was absolutely silent." There's a curious entry in Bill's diary. "In 1968, the first Xerox dry photocopy machine is patented. This is puzzling because xerography was patented way before 1968. Shurtleff was so exacting and careful, I assume he was either aware of some later Xerox patent that happened that year and thought it was the first, or maybe he meant to write that the inventor of xerography, Chester Carlson, died that year and got his wires crossed. We'd had services for Carlson at Tassajara and Sokoji. Carlson had donated more than all other donors combined toward the purchase of Tassajara and was honored in memory and services. He was an attorney who'd worked in the patent office and wished they'd had a better way to make copies of documents, as all the available methods were impractical. He started experimenting in his apartment's kitchen. The first commercial machine, the Xerox 914, went on sale in 1959. His wife, Doris, got interested in Buddhism, and Carlson provided major funds for the establishment of the Rochester Zen Center. Xerox was headquartered in Rochester, and Edo Shimano's New York Zen Studies. From a windbell that came out late in 1968, on Thursday, September 19th, Chester F. Carlson, a generous benefactor of Buddhism in America and the first founder of Zen Mountain Center, died in New York. The following is a tribute to Mr. Carlson, written by Richard Baker, who attended the funeral with Suzuki at Mrs. Carlson's request. In that tribute, Baker wrote, "He was one of the greatest philanthropists of our time, viewing his immense fortune, earned only since the 1940s, as a public trust in which the value of the dollar was determined by the good it could do for those who needed help. He supported at levels no other individual has equaled the peace movement, psychical research, civil rights and integration, institutions dedicated to preserving our basic freedoms, universities, Vedantism and Zen Buddhism, and important individual research of such persons as a Nobel laureate and a Vietnamese monk. These accomplishments were attributes of a man everyone felt kindly toward. On the day before he died, Mr. Carlson bought a balloon on a New York corner and immediately released it to fly over the city. He told his wife, 'I wanted it to be free.' The next day he died. I find him now in every person I meet and for all the people practicing at Zen Mountain Center, which he did so much to create. He is there too." Suzuki later wrote to Carlson's widow, Doris, in a letter dated May 12, 1969. "Dear Mrs. Carlson, it is already more than 6 months since I saw you. Sorry I haven't written you, but I have too many things to say. I was supposed to come and see you in May, but I am not well yet since I suffered from Hong Kong flu from January. I am pretty well now, but my doctor said I couldn't make a long trip yet. Now, as Peter can visit you, I want to send a Tassajara stone. I am always seeking for a suitable stone here in Tassajara Mountain to put your husband's name on as a founder of Zen Mountain Center. We have many kinds of stone here. If you dip this one in water, it will be very beautiful. I hope you will like it. With Gosho, Reverend Shunyu Suzuki. I think he meant, if you pour water on this one, I bet it was too big to dip. This has been a Kyuk Audio podcast. I'm D.C. Puba of Kyuk Audio and Kyuk Archives, coming to you from Sleepy Sanur with Doggett Bandita, Feline Kuchita, and dear lovely Katrinka. And we're wishing you and yours and all of us a grand awakening.